The official story is that Carter, by his own account, felt almost overwhelmed by the urge to break open the irksome door, but resisted and buried the stairs once again. He waited more than 2 weeks, ostensibly without taking any action, for his chain-smoking sponsor to arrive. Carnarvon traveled to Luxor by ship, railroad, and steamboat on the Nile. Together with his 21-year-old daughter, Evelyn, he alighted at the glamorous Winter Palace Hotel and rushed, having barely slept, to the Valley of the Kings. They began to clear the descending corridor, which also showed signs of a grave robber's effort. By November 4th, is that right? By November 26th, the corridor was cleared and the team found a second door and again faced with plaster, stamped over with oval seals and reclosed at the top left-hand corner. At first, their enthusiasm was somewhat dampened, but at the top left-hand corner, the blockings were signs of reclosure, suggesting that the tomb had already been entered during antiquity. It was clear that Carter had indeed discovered the tomb of Tutankhamun. Not knowing what lay beyond this door, carefully, under Carnarvon's watchful eye, Carter eased the doorway open with a chisel his grandmother had given him for his 17th birthday. Love that detail. Carter made a small hole in it and inserted a candle to test for foul gases. He then peered into the void beyond, reporting, "Can you see anything?" Lord Carnarvon asked. "Indeed." Howard Carter could. Even in the dim candlelight, he could spy gold fixtures inside the tomb. "Yes, wonderful things," the archaeologist exclaimed. Howard Carter was gazing upon the intact tomb of the young Tutankhamun. The story of the newly discovered and intact burial... That phrase doesn't even make sense. "Yes, no, wonderful things," the archaeologist explained. Carter was gazing upon the intact tomb of the young King Tutankhamun. "At first I could see nothing," he said. "The hot air escaping from the chamber caused the candle flame to flicker. But presently, as my eyes grew accustomed to the light, details of the room within emerged slowly from the mist. Strange animals, statues, and gold everywhere, the glint of gold." Carter's words, "We have seen enough. We plug the hole again." Again and again, authors attest to this solemn moment in which the archaeologist looked on that internal palace, dazed, spellbound, awed, and yet managed to keep his head. Then, according to the excavation leader, he stopped in order to notify the Egyptian inspector general as duty required.
And all of that was a lie. What really took place can be gathered from a report that Lord Carnarvon wrote shortly before his death. Instead of waiting dutifully as regulations required, the party forced its way through the narrow opening right away. Using tallow candles and a weak electrical lamp, the interlopers first entered the antechamber. Golden beds and beautifully carved chairs were piled up in the narrow room, as well as gaming tables and precious vases. Oval basins held food for the dead pharaoh. Animal figures shone from the posts of gilded litters, monstrous in the weak cone of light from the lamp. The explorers moved chests, trampled brittle woven baskets, and pocketed perfume jars, opening chests in the side chamber as well. And of course, Howard Carter had discovered the boy pharaoh's tomb of Tutankhamun. But not in the way that that history tells us, Marie, not in that kind of sweet way.
Or maybe it was. I mean, it's so maybe probably not as romanticized as was written. But as we find out, you know, in studying more about King Tut, like everything he touched and everything he talked about during this time, the late 1920s, just got blown bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, it's so interesting. So. I don't know. It's so weird. It's like such a strange part of the story, I guess, to have him be, I don't know. I think it's interesting that you say it like that. It gets blown and blown and blown up more, right? Because Yes. It's such a weird, like, he discovers the tomb and then he's like, "Close it up. We must fill out the paperwork." Like, is that really a heroic story? I mean, I guess it is for today's archaeologists.
Well, it speaks to what we do know about him, right? That he was not someone who he was
very
prone
annoying.
To anger. He was very annoying. He was prone to anger, but he had great self-discipline, right? He was the one who could sit for hours on end in the dark with just a candle, tracing exact replicas of what he saw on the wall. So I have a feeling that maybe there's somewhat of some truth to that, but then I don't think that he probably followed everything by the exact letter of the law, because this was a huge once-in-a-lifetime event as well. So I can only imagine that he did probably have to wait for Carnarvon to show up after, you know, having his whirlwind trip, luxury, you know, by luxury liner and stuff. I also love the fact that he's described as a chain smoker, which is pretty hysterical.
That is kind of funny, considering our introduction to Carnarvon is like he's too sickly to work anymore. So yeah. His doctors were probably like, well, if you smoke 12 of these a day, you should get real healthy real quick.
Right.
As they said at the time.
I know. And I even love the idea of him having sort of one of those long cigarette holders, maybe too, you know, with some Egyptian motif on it, right? That he's, you know, peering over Carter's shoulder, trying to see what he's doing. And Carter's like, dude, can you please just give me some space? You know, I've got personal issues with that already. And you're bugging me with the cigarette smoke.
Right.
Tell me to bust it open.
Oh, my God.
I know. But so now we can, you know, he's discovered the boy Pharaoh's tomb.
So Tutankhamun, or King Tut, ruled after the Amarna Age when the Pharaoh Akhenaten, who we believe was King Tut's father, turned the religious attention of the kingdom away from polytheism to monotheism, specifically to worship the god Aten, who was in some parts of Egypt considered like the sun disk, in other places considered like an all-father type of god, and other places to be like the sun, like the power of the sun that brings to the land. So like, mm-hmm. It's weird. A lot of Christianity and a lot of like Christian mythology, symbolism and everything else comes from this god Aten in Egyptian lore. So like the idea of a single godhead being three, like, and this has nothing to do with like whether or not you believe Christianity is real or not or whatever, but just like the overarching storyline and ideas that influenced the way that the Bible is written and the myths that were used in the Bible to convey meaning and everything else. Some of that came from ancient Egypt, and some of these ideas were around for a much longer time. Mm-hmm. So this idea of like the god Aten being three figures in one, obviously anyone who knows Christian mythology or is a Christian themselves or a Catholic will know the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, right? Or the kind of three-figured godhead of Catholicism. So mm-hmm. Akhenaten is considered like the hated pharaoh, right? He's the one that's been stripped from all the records and everything else because he moved Egypt from polytheism to monotheism. So Akhenaten moved his capital city to the state of Akhetaten, also known as Amarna, in Middle Egypt, which is really far from the previous capital of the pharaohs. And after Akhenaten's death and the rule of his successor, Smenkhar, Tutankhamun shifted the focus of the country's worship back away from Aten to the god Amun and returned the religious center back to Thebes. So basically, the reason that Tutankhamun is so celebrated, whereas Akhenaten is sort of hated, is because Tutankhamun basically comes back and says, like, we're going back to the old religion. Clearly that didn't work. You know what I mean? Whatever.
Mm-hmm. He made Egypt great again.
So King Tut marries his half-sister, which is, like, not weird at all.
Ankhes fairly common at the time, right? Again.
Yeah, that's fine.
The bloodline was kept in royal blood kind of thing.
Got to keep that bloodline pure so the lips can be small and the heads can be large. So Tut marries his half-sister. Her name is something like Akhesenamun, although who knows if I'm saying that correct. They didn't produce an heir. So there wasn't like a clear line of succession.
Right.
On top of that, King Tut dies at 18. Although some people, they're not sure about how he died, right, Marie? So give me some of the options here.
So there's much speculation to his death. It could have been a chariot accident, thrown from his royal chariot. He could have been murdered by the back, by a blow to the back of the head, because they found some damage there when they looked at the mummies we'll get into. Or it could have even been reports of a hippopotamus attack. You know, I think that's probably lesser contender. However, the total answer is still unclear. Tutankhamun's much older advisor and probably like his step-grandfather, married his widowed bride and then became pharaoh. So again, okay. Like the advisor, but go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so, so continue your thoughts. So the advice, okay. Continue your thought.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, leading to a possible power grab, right? Which is one of the thoughts that, the boy king was too popular, but you know, too weak. He wasn't producing an heir. And so they stepped in, you know, his supporting power structure stepped in, murdered him, and then took his place.
Just like Biggie and Tupac.
Well, actually, nothing like Biggie and Tupac, but...
fine, whatever, Marie. So, okay, one thing I want to... Actually, one thing I want to say before we get into, like, the actual getting of the stuff from the tomb, too. All these names, like Tutankhamun, Akhenaten, you know... The pharaohs of Egypt had like a really complicated naming convention for themselves. So they all had like a birth name, but then they had a royal name, which was like the name of their like deity kind. Cause like pharaohs were considered to be gods, you know, they were like the representation of God on earth. So they all had like a regular name and then like a god name. And then they had like other names on top of that too. Like, so if you're reading about King Tut or Akhenaten or any of these other people too, it can get really complicated because the names that we know them by aren't necessarily the names that, like, they were written about as, I guess I would say. So, like, so Tutankhamun, for example, has a bunch of other names as well. So he has, just loads of other names, which is really exciting and weird. But I don't know, kind of interesting. I always think that's really interesting. I don't know why.
Well, because he's too important just to have one moniker, right? I mean, he's not one thing. So they have to describe him as this huge multitude of things because he is that much to their world. Or that's what they're trying to convey, right? He's not just the king. He's the god. He's not just the god. He's sort of the all-powerful, our all-powerful father. You know, he's the husband, yada, yada, yada. Like, I think that that's kind of... You know, that's kind of indicative of something that's trying to imbue the ruling class with more than just, you know, they're just the king or they're just the pharaoh.
No, exactly. So like, so his two names, right, that he's most well known by are Tutankhaten, which that one means living image of Aten, and then Tutankhamun, which means living image of Amun. And so when his father, Akhenaten, was alive and Aten was the main god, he was known as Tutankhaten. But when he switched the religion back over, he became Tutankhamun to be the living image of Amun instead of the living image
See
of
See how Aten. That works? See?
Yeah, so it's...
It's sort of interesting because you think you'd only be the living image of one god.
It's funny how that happens.
You'd stick with that for the, you know, the full 18 years, but nope, moving it.
Yeah, kind of an interesting thing.
It's just all, it's political. It's a huge political thing. It's like, I'm going to take the name of the god that's going to give us the most stability, right? And I'm sure of it. Like, again, he had advisors, as we see here with the step grandfather who might or might not have seized power. But regardless of like his name, he was known, you know, later on, again, we'll talk about this, but he is known as King Tut, right? That is... in the papers and in the media at the time that was the moniker that they shortened it to that, you know, was able to have everyone kind of latch onto it and understand it and be able to say it.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So getting back into the actual dig and the retrieval of the items, the excavation and removing everything from the tomb took 10 years, and the final objects were only shipped to Cairo in the spring of 1932. And again, like, this attracted more worldwide publicity than any other scientific moment in that up to that time. So this was like, you know, the biggest thing that could have happened in science, period. There wasn't the moon landing yet, et cetera, but this was a huge, huge, huge national event. And in the antechamber, which was the first room to be cleared, again, just like we described before, there were wooden sculptures, there were chariots, pieces of furniture, boxes, like chests just crammed full of like delicate fabric and jewelry and even cosmetics, ceramic vessels full of foodstuff and wine for his voyage into the afterlife, and just hundreds and hundreds of articles of clothing. So like sandals that were so delicate that they basically, after all this time, you know, couldn't even be touched because they would fall apart. Like linen gloves, and there's descriptions of wreaths of dried flowers that were probably thrown into the antechamber, maybe at the last minute by his worshipers and his young widow. But all of this, which is sort of, again, very romanticized view, yes, but could, you know, it was a funeral site. So it would have been, you know, it would have had some sort of closing event, right? I mean, basically some sort of funeral or something that they would attest to. But what I thought was so interesting is this is also where they start to talk about the conservation of these things that are clearly affected by age, and how do they move them, and how they had to be conserved and stabilized in paraffin wax before they could be moved. But Carter himself, and again, this is another one of my favorite quotes besides describing Carnarvon as the chain smoker, likened this room to the property room of an opera of a vanished civilization. So a sort of like sort of this props room of backstage where it's just all this jumble of stuff kind of crammed together that doesn't really make any sense. But just literally is representative and filled with what they believe were the king's favorite things, that the stuff that was going to be buried with him, and the belief that his spirit form could enjoy them into the afterlife.
What's interesting, too, is that they think there might be today. So if you look up any. The idea that they could bring it into the afterlife, I think, is really funny, because if you look at pictures of what the tomb they think, you know, probably looked like based on Carter's, you know, writings about it and cataloging and everything else, it looked like a complete mess, like a hoarder's buried alive situation, yeah. You know, just like gold stuff piled upon gold stuff and like random things and whatever. What's interesting, though, is that so the kind of accepted the accepted rooms are there's the main corridor, then the antechamber being filled with, you know, gold stuff and treasures and everything else. There is an annex room, which is like kind of behind the antechamber. There is the burial chamber itself, which so you kind of walk down the corridor, you're going to the antechamber. The annex is like to the back left of the antechamber. The treasure room is a doorway in the annex on the far right hand side that you go into. It's just this big ass room with the sarcophagus and everything else in it. And then on the other side of the sarcophagus, so kind of kitty corner to the door of the antechamber, is the treasure chamber. Kind of scans and stuff. So one kind of prevailing idea or prevailing mystery, I guess, is the idea that, you know, there are hidden rooms in King Tut's tomb, right? Or there's like a hidden room in the Sphinx or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, modern scanning shows that there might be hollow chambers there that actually do suggest maybe there being other rooms and stuff, but like there's like hidden doorways maybe or whatever. But the thing is, like Marie said, they were putting this stuff there so that the king could get it when he came back as like a ghost. So it's kind of an interesting
form. Yeah, that this would all accompany it with him, right? Like that this is his, these are the things he loved. And so, you know, when they say, well, when you die, you can't take it with you. No, King Tut did.
Totally can. You know, totally
you got
can.
Enough money.
You totally bury me can. In my roller skates, Marie. So the interestingly, too, I think a thing you said or mentioned there was this idea that like all the minute they open the tomb, stuff starts deteriorating immediately.
Yes. Which I think is fascinating.
Because you have stuff that already hasn't really, I mean, obviously they've been mummified and stuff has been dried and everything else and whatever, but it, you know, it's not like the ancient Egyptians had a great idea about how to preserve organic items. You know what I mean? And by organic, I mean like non-gold, right? Like not rocks and metal, stuff that actually could degrade in atmosphere. They seal it up. And so you can imagine that some level of kind of homeostasis, or homeostasis is the wrong word, but some kind of level of equilibrium has been reached inside the chamber where stuff is degrading, but it's degrading at like a normal time, or not a normal time, but it just doesn't have any of the outside forces.
Exactly. Yeah, it's not like it's pressurized because it was probably not airtight, but it's sort of like there's nothing from the outside that's come in over 3,000 years. So it's not just like a couple hundred years. It's like thousands of years old, like 3,245 years old. So
right. And then they open it up. And so immediately stuff starts to, like, you can imagine this is stuff that probably hasn't hit a lot of humidity.
Yes.
In thousands of years. So suddenly you have humidity, you have sand, you have just new air, right? Mm-hmm. Spreading chemical and whatever, like other things that weren't there before. So it's a really interesting, it's a really interesting like chemistry problem in my head, kind of.
It is. And the chemistry comes up later on when we talk about his curse.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure does.
But yeah, so they get past the antechamber, like you were saying, and they get to the innermost coffin. And this is probably the thing that is the most thought of when we think about King Tut and King Tut's tomb. So the sarcophagus held three coffins in total. The two outer ones were created in wood and then covered in gold with semi-precious stones. So again, real ornate, and was, but mostly made out of wood and was made to hold what, you know, the mummy of the king. The innermost, however, was solid gold. But when Howard Carter opened it and came across it, it wasn't the shiny gold that we think of, right? That's now in the museum. From his excavation notes, he states that it was covered in a thick, pitch-like layer, which extended from the hands to the ankles. And what they think is that this was some sort of an anointing liquid which had been poured over the coffin during the burial. Basically just drenching the whole coffin that was gold and just burying it under this black layer of pitch, which I think probably had two main purposes. One, again, to anoint the god with some sort of, some sort of holy, annotation to see him into the next world. But then also, you know, a pitch black liquid to sort of dissuade anyone from thinking that that coffin is anything, right? Because it's just now sticky black pitch.
Yeah, it could be, for dry, sure. Yeah.
You know?
And with that, we are going to go into our first break. And we're back. Okay, so this sarcophagus, it's all kind of covered in goop, and it's wood, and then there's lapis lazuli and gold and everything else. You can finally get to the last one. And so you get this golden, you get off all the gunk and you get this golden image of a god. And so that image is supposed to be what the god, what the pharaoh will look like in the afterlife, because the Egyptian people thought at the time that the gods were golden. They literally had skin of gold. They had bones of silver. Their hair was made of lapis lazuli, which makes combing it a nightmare.
Complexion's great.
It is great. So the picture there, or that image on the sarcophagus, is actually supposed to be what King Tut, it's thought, would have looked like in the afterlife. On the same time, so he's holding a crook and flail, which were symbols of the kings. And then the goddess's Nekbet is shown as a vulture, and Wajit is shown as a cobra. That they're stretching their wings across his torso. So these two goddesses are protecting him. Beneath those goddesses are two more, Isis and Nephthys, that again are etched into the golden lid. And that death mask of the pharaoh actually originally rested on the mummy itself inside the coffin, inside the innermost golden portion. And it's It's this thing is crazy. It's two sheets of gold hammered together. It weighs 22.5 pounds, so like 10.2 kgs.
Oh my god!
Too heavy for a mummy. Too heavy for a mummy.
Well, just like, I mean, just like, again, think about like the overkill. Like, that's an amazing, like, just so he died relatively suddenly. Let's just kind of spell this out really quick. He died relatively suddenly, you know, of unknown causes, perhaps. So how long did it take to get all this stuff prepared? Because this is not stuff that they had sitting around, or maybe they had been preparing it since his birth. And this was something that they were going to, you know, like they had ready for every pharaoh. I haven't done the research to figure that out, but it's like, this is amazing craftsmanship, masterpieces. And like, I'm curious to know how long they had this stuff before they entombed him.
Well, I think, doesn't the mummification process take a long time too?
Yeah, it takes, yeah, I think my, so again, we would probably need to do
it took like 70 to 80 days to mummify a pharaoh. Right. So figure from the time he dies, they have, you know, 3 months, give or take, to come up with all this stuff. And I think, too, like he did die suddenly, like you said. Mm-hmm. But I do think, again, cannot say for certain here, but I believe, and listeners, if you know this, please let us know. Yeah. But I believe they were preparing for their deaths like the whole time. Being a pharaoh was not a very, it seems like it's a little...
A lot of longevity. There was a lot of risk, right? Yeah. You got to go into the afterlife with a lot of stuff, but there was a lot of risk.
No, a hell of a lot of risk. So, gets to go there with a lot of stuff, but there's a lot of risk there. Yeah. So the thing that he's wearing too, that's not his hair, that headdress thing, the nemes. Mm-hmm. It's a headcloth that is supposed to just be like, you know, that's another signal of royalty. Same thing with that big beard that's false. That's also supposed to be directing him or showing him as a god pharaoh. It's really interesting, kind of the headdress and the ornamentation that they utilized. On top of that, too, the back of the death mask itself is covered with spell 151B from the Book of the Dead, which basically is like the roadmap for the afterlife. It's supposed to protect the king's body as it moves through the different kind of chambers of the afterlife to get to finally the final reward, essentially, right? So anyone who's played Assassin's Creed Origins, actually, you've probably played through this part where you have to, like, you know, you fight the giant snake and, like, you know, so it's really interesting. They had this, like, very complex methodology of going from, like, proving your worth in the afterlife to show, you know, was your life moral, and are you good enough to move on, basically?
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. All of that portion of this, I think, is really fascinating. And Lord Carnarvon thought, well, that's pretty interesting. Let's make some frickin' money. You know,
he lit up another cigarette and said, you know, Howard, I think we can make some bucks off of this.
Yeah. So it's crazy. It's actually kind of crazy. Like Carter and Carnarvon. So they make a deal with what's the name of this one here?
The London Times.
Okay. Yeah. So they make a deal with the London Times newspaper, basically, to sell these photographs that Harry Burton, who's a photographer at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, British born, he's brought in to do these pictures, which if you've seen pictures of the excavation, these are probably the ones that you've seen. And what's interesting is his background
was like stage in Hollywood. And again, not really indicative of what the actual event was or the actual uncovering of the event, but sort of like this huge production of what the event should have been like, right? So he came up and it was like all the stage lighting and things that were being developed in Hollywood at the time to make it as dramatic as possible, right? And so like, you know, they had it like he was going to come in and he be take some of the first photographs of the untouched antechamber of the tomb, which had been like, you know, been tromped through by workers for several weeks, visited by like dozens of people. And at that point had been totally rigged out for electrical lighting, which I think is kind of hysterical because it's like, you know, immediately Carnarvon was like, all right, so we have to, you know, we're going to get this very famous photographer in here, but we have to make sure that this tells this really compelling story because this is a big deal. And then one other point that I love too is that Carnarvon sold the story and the photographs to the London Times, but he kept the movie rights. There's a savvy guy. He kept the film rights for himself because he's like, oh, I smell a series. I smell, you know, not just one story, but multiple stories. This is going to be big.
Well, what's interesting too is that despite all of this like effort to make this a media sensation, everything else, they really didn't know what they were doing in terms of conserving the items. They found a lot of stuff, but it's thought today that only a very small portion were lost ultimately, right? That it's a 0.25% of them were lost, despite there being a lot of objects discovered. And this is often said to be due to the work of Alfred Lucas in particular, who was a chemist on Carter's team, who devised methods to like conserve these items in different ways, which I think is really kind of an interesting and cool part of the story that we never hear that guy's name.
No.
You know what I mean? No. We never hear about Alfred Lucas, although he was a very... it was a very important part of this.
Right, because he was the one who actually got them out in one piece.
Yes.
Right, which I think is fascinating because, again, to your point, this stuff had been sequestered away for thousands of years. And so how do you, I mean, 10 years it took to kind of get everything or what they believe is everything out and as much of it in one piece as possible. And at the same time, sort of monetizing the hell out of it, right? So it's like they're trying to do both. I think that it's an interesting dichotomy of trying to do both at the same time, which again will have mixed results.
Absolutely. So on top of kind of the funny, like the monetary aspects of all this, that Carnarvon was like, sweet, now we can make money. On top of that too, so the Times publishes these photographs, the first ones on January 1923, the 30th of January, and then they're sold around just to like the world generally. But the problem is that, you know, in the time that Carter and Carnarvon had been searching for this stuff, the politics of searching for antiquities changed a little bit. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, you know, Europe and especially Britain didn't have all the say in who got to like keep the stuff and sell the discovery and everything else because they were the people of Egypt by birthright. Yeah. You know, these are their ancestors this is their antiquities that you're kind of like, yeah, you're studying them and everything else. But, you know, this is Egyptian. These are Egyptian items. So,
yeah,
what's kind of interesting is they never gave the Egyptian press access to the story. So it's like people in Egypt have to read about the discovery of their own historical antiquities from
the London Times. You know,
the London Times. Yeah, it's like going through another person to get to them, which is kind of crazy. Which on top of that, too. Just
colonial as hell, too, right?
It's terrible.
Like they're probably, and again, they're starting to like commoditize the idea of Egypt as well. This is when sort of the fad of the Egyptian, of all things Egypt, comes into play with King Tut.
Yeah, and what's, you know, it's interesting, right? So despite, like, Carter and Carnarvon, at least Carter, being, in previous episodes, we had kind of talked about him as being almost like a positive force, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think in many ways he was.
Yes.
There's no way to look at historical figures and take only the good, though. And right. This is one area that he was sort of... He thought, I've been given the right to study these things. I've been given the right to dig for them. So by rights, if I find them, you know, finders keepers.
Well, yeah, you know? I'm not giving them back.
No, there's no way.
10 years of my life. And I, you know, and again, like it is this entitlement to something that really was not theirs.
Right. It was never theirs to begin with.
No.
And so it took until 1929 for basically Carter and Carnarvon to stop fighting about whether or not they would get to bring a mummy home to their houses, essentially. Right. They thought they could bring home, like in previous eras of digging, mm-hmm. or previous years of digging, that they would be able to bring home, like, you know,
all the treasure.
Yeah, a little bit of treasure, right? A little bit of treasure off the top.
To set up in the grand salon and then point out to the other lords and ladies about stuff, right? Like it was their own collection. This was for their own amusement.
Right. But so interestingly, despite that kind of colonial view on this archaeology and this find, the Egyptian government held firm.
Yeah.
And said, no, this is stuff that stays in the Egyptian Museum here in Cairo. Doing the dig and everything else is fine because you've asked us for permission, but none of this is going home with you. None of this is going into a British museum or an American museum. All of that has to come with us. And you've already pissed us off by selling the photos to not, you know, by selling the photos that you had no right to do that either. Right. So it's kind of interesting. This is really the besides the fact that it's a turning point in archaeology because of the popularity of the field that gets made with this discovery. It's also kind of a turning point in like the politics of archaeology.
Yes. And sort of what they're described as the colonial arrogance. It was a foregone conclusion that this was theirs. This is a major event where they're like, no, it's not. And it actually, that was the case. And they weren't it wasn't overthrown or it wasn't changed. That was the ruling and that was what happened. Which I think is a major historic event too, which we don't really associate with this event. But it was the biggest scientific event of its time, bar none, and sort of the quote unquote fruits of the labor or the spoils were not ever realized by the colonial empire themselves.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
So it is very interesting. So all of this kind of politicking back and forth and anger led to Carter actually being like locked out of the tomb. Like literally.
they changed
the lock on the gate to the tomb. So he had to stop working there for a number of years and then only returned back in 1933. And you know, as that resumed, Burton continued to photograph these objects and everything else. And it's from these photographs and sort of the surroundings. I think part of it is the political intrigue, but also kind of the drama of what happens next that we end up with the topic of next week's final episode in the King Tut Howard Carter saga. The curse.
The mummy's curse.
Thank you again, dear listeners, for listening to the Mad Scientist Podcast. I have been your host, Chris Cogswell, joined by my co-host,
Marie Mayhew.
If you'd like to contact the show, please send us an email at themadscientistpodcast@gmail.com. That's all one word. You can also follow us on Twitter at Mad Scientist Pod or at Team Giant Squid for Marie. And of course, you can see us on Facebook, on Instagram, and all over the internet as the Mad Scientist Podcast. And again, our logo is the one with the pumpkin head, so it's easy to see.
Mm-hmm.
If you've enjoyed the show tonight, please consider supporting us on Patreon, where the money that you give to us will help us to promote this show further, to make it better, and just to spend more time making it.
Because we love doing that.
We do love doing that. Our logo was designed by Carrie Shaheen. Our web design is done by Desdemona Howard. And our sound design is done by Jake Cardinal. Thanks again for listening.
Thank you. This has been a Damn It Chippy production.
Yeah, so wait, I think we mispronounced some of those.
Oh, did we? Did I? We, as in me.
What really took place can be gathered from a report that Lord Carnarvon wrote shortly before his death. Instead of waiting... And all of that is a lie. Tutankhamun ruled after the Amarna Age, when the pharaoh Akhenaten, who was Tutankhamun... Oh my god. Mm-hmm. There's too many Amens. Too many Amens.
Amens and Amens.